Hey, y'all. It's the NPR Politics Podcast. Every single week here at NPR Politics and in our daily lives, at the bar, at the grocery store, on the phone with our families and friends, we get asked some variation of this question. When it comes to the Republican Party, given the way the race is going, what is a contested convention or an open convention or a brokered convention? What happens there? What does it look like? Who decides? Well, we found a guy who can answer all those questions, and that's what we'll do this episode. First, some intros. I'm Sam Sanders, campaign reporter.
I'm Susan Davis. I cover Congress.
And I'm Domenico Montanaro, political editor.
So we have to say up front, this is a conversation about the GOP, not the Democrats, and there is a reason for this?
Well, mostly the reason is because there's only two candidates on the Democratic side. So the odds of there being a contested or an open convention are harder. It's a more clear system in place for the Democrats. They have this proportional allocation, and they really do try to avoid something that looks like an open or contested convention. Now, if they do get there, if Bernie Sanders can get enough of those pledged delegates, if he does get there a little later in the process, then we'll seek out somebody on the Democratic side who could maybe explain some of this.
Okay. And so the guy we talked to get some answers on all this for the GOP is a guy named Ben Ginsburg. Sue, who is he?
Ben Ginsburg is one of the preeminent lawyers for the Republican Party. He is probably best known, he was the national counsel for the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2000 and 2004, who oversaw the 2000 recount. He was also the national counsel for Mitt Romney, both in 2008 and 2012. He is not currently consulting for the RNC, although he is the type of guy that the party can often lean on for legal counsel or advice. And he is a lawyer at the Jones Day Law Firm, which we should say is also represents Donald Trump, but he is not connected to that campaign. It is represented by a different lawyer at the Jones Day Law Firm.
So he's a big deal.
He's a big deal. And he's very well known. He's very well liked within the party.
And mostly he gets this stuff.
Yeah. And he's an absolute expert on the RNC party rules, the law, and all the questions you may have. Ben is a really good source to answer those questions.
Cool. So to set this up, we talked to Ben about what could happen in this increasingly likely scenario where none of the GOP candidates get to the convention in July with that magic number of 1,237 delegates. This gets nerdy. You have been warned. The first thing to know is that where the party goes at that point, if no one gets 1,237, it totally depends on the rules. And it's the rules the party lays out for itself at its convention. And that takes place just before the convention starts, right?
Right. Well, and the rules are important. For instance, there's something called Rule 40B, where we said we're going to get nerdy on this. This has to do with the only candidate who can become the nominee for the party. It can be somebody who's won a majority of delegates in at least 8 states. Now, this is a rule that they put in place in 2012 because someone like Ron Paul had gained so many delegates in places where he didn't win all that vote. So they're going to reconsider this rule.
They could throw it out.
Yeah, and why that's really important is because Ted Cruz and Donald Trump are going to be the only two people going into this convention who have won 8 states. So in other words, you're going to have if this rule is not thrown out, then only Ted Cruz or Donald Trump can be the Republican nominee.
And the other thing that is so interesting is that, a lot of the delegates that are going to go into the convention in Cleveland are unbound, which means they can vote for whoever they want. And then if we could have this multi-ballot system, more and more delegates will become unbound. The system will become more and more unpredictable. I mean, it is a very intricate process, but it's also a process that smart campaigns are already starting to game to make sure that they have an advantage on the floor if we do have an open convention.
Okay. So with that, here's the three of us with lawyer Ben Ginsburg with the answers to all of these questions. We start with the question, when do those rules that are so important actually get decided?
The process, in a sense, has already started. The Republican National Committee has a standing committee on rules that meets in between the conventions to discuss the implications of the rules. They will prepare what amounts to a working draft. That will be ratified by the Republican National Committee when it meets in Cleveland, traditionally the Wednesday before the convention.
And who's in that group?
That's the 168 members of the National Committee, 3 people from each state and territory. So what's passed by the Republican National Committee on Wednesday becomes the working draft that goes to a temporary Convention Rules Committee.
Oh, my goodness.
That is made up of a man and a woman from each of the 56 states and territories, so 112 people.
Does it have to be a man and a woman?
Yes, it does.
What?
Indeed.
No.
Yeah.
Why? Because I mean, this is great. It's diversity, but, like, that's really...
Well, that's part of... That's
really,
the, yeah.
It's part of what makes the Republican Party tick.
Okay.
So what follows then? You go the 168 to 112 to...
So the 112 in the Temporary Convention Rules Committee will meet on Friday. They'll deal with the draft rules presented to it by the Republican National Committee. That committee can then amend the 8-state rule if they wish, leave it the same. But they have to do something.
But you know the people on that committee.
Don't know the people on that committee.
Oh.
Because they're the delegates that are being chosen.
Oh,
they're chosen,
I see.
Two from each state and territory,
so it's
by the delegation.
So it's also in Cruz's and Trump's and Kasich's favor to influence these delegates, not just for the number of delegate votes, but also for influence on the Rules Committee?
Yes, very important.
Okay.
And each of the campaigns is stressing this to get their supporters on the Rules Committee. Very important in the process.
Okay.
Is that part of what Cruz is trying to do as he's trying to pick off these delegates one by one in Colorado, Wyoming?
Cruz and Trump both. I mean, what you saw in Colorado was
Let's
Cruz...
catch up folks that don't know what happened in Colorado. Someone want to explain that really quickly?
So in Colorado over the weekend, Ted Cruz was able to win all 34 of the delegates that were allocated this weekend. Part of that was because it was very strong on the ground field operation. They were,
and there was no Colorado primary or caucus.
So there's no statewide vote in Colorado, but they wanted to maintain their convention process and their caucus process so that they could pick them from, you know, precinct level all the way through to the state convention to then get those folks to go to the national convention.
So sort of the opposite happened in Michigan over this past weekend.
Okay.
The Trump folks and the Kasich folks combined forces and divided up who would get to go to the Rules Committee. So Ted Cruz kind of lost out.
Trump and Kasich paired up.
Trump and Kasich paired up.
What signs should we draw from that?
I think you should draw from that this is a competitive and open process.
But not like a VP situation going on here?
No, I don't think this is VP. I think this was more the people in the individual states sort of wanting to make a statement within that state. In Tennessee, weekend before last, the Tennessee State Executive Committee gets to slot delegates for the various committees. They slotted a couple of members of the Republican National Committee to be Trump delegates, even although they had never before exhibited any support for Donald Trump. So that's an instance of Trump getting two establishment people to act as his delegates. The question is, will they be loyal to Trump when it comes time for individual votes on things like rules?
Because I feel like lots of people assume once the votes have happened at this caucus or primary, that's it. It's done. It's clear that Trump gets this many, Cruz gets that many. But actually, there's some space left for change to happen.
On the first ballot, the votes of the people in the primaries is determinative and binds the delegates.
So, at the convention, you're saying?
At the convention, yes. So the vote will take place in primaries and caucuses in states. That will determine how many delegates each candidate has on the first ballot. Then the process will take place of who those delegates are. So different states have different number of ballots to which they bind the delegates. So in some instances, delegates will be bound only for the first ballot. That's true in roughly three-quarters of the states. Few other states bind their delegates for two ballots if it goes that far, some for three, and then a small number for however many ballots there might be at a convention.
So, I mean, this is obviously a crazy intricate process, and we end up now in this year where Donald Trump, who seems like he will end up with the majority of votes after all the contests,
most votes.
He could have a big chance of not winning the nomination. That, to a lot of voters and to a lot of Trump supporters, seems like it's unfair. And hearing this process described, it seems in some way unnecessarily murky. Like, is there any claim? I mean, like, are folks justified to say, hey, this whole thing just seems a bit fishy?
Well, there are a couple of responses to that. Number one is that since 1856, the Republican Party has had in its rules that the nominee is the person who gets a majority of delegates. And the reason behind that, if you go back and read the history of the rules, is a desire to have at least the majority of Republicans in favor of the person who's the nominee. It's the way the rules have always been. The notion of whether it's a majority or plurality is part of a rule that will have to be passed by the 2016 convention. So the solution...
So you mean they could lower it?
They could lower it. Yeah, the solution for Mr. Trump, it's Rule 40D&E, if anyone wants to read them, say that it has to be a majority of delegates. But that can be amended by the Convention Rules Committee and then the convention to be a plurality of delegates. So there's a solution in that.
Okay, so if we get close to the convention and no one has the magic number, we hear the terms open convention, contested convention, brokered convention. Is there a difference? What is the difference? And what are you calling this?
Well, I'm not calling it a brokered convention because I don't think there are any brokers left in the Republican Party.
You're a broker.
I'm broke. I'm not a broker. The reality is it's not clear who's going to be able to command state delegations and individuals like in the old days where a state party chair or national party chair or a governor would control almost every delegation that came to the floor. I think that is not the reality of where things are today in the Republican Party. So I think we should not call it a brokered convention.
Okay. So then between open and contested, is there a difference? What do they mean?
I think they mean the same thing.
Oh.
It means there's not a predetermined outcome.
Okay.
You might use multi-ballot convention just for a third term to throw imprecisely into the mix.
Is it possible if someone goes in, a candidate goes in without the magic number, that they could still win it on the first ballot?
Yes. Depends on the math a lot. There will be somewhere between 160 and 200 unbound delegates on the first ballot. Huh. So they are capable of wooing, the 40 days of wooing. From
now, are those the folks that voted previously for someone like Rubio, or is that in a different number?
That's too a different number. Well, the folks who voted for a previous candidate, whether Rubio, Carson, Bush, whoever, who won delegates, you have to look at the laws of the individual states to know if they're bound for the first ballot or not.
But most delegates are bound on the first ballot.
Most delegates.
Even for the name of a candidate who dropped out.
Even for the name of a candidate who dropped out.
Okay. So then what is the precedent for this historically? Because there have been conventions where you've gone to first ballot not knowing who's going to get it. This happened before, right?
Yeah. The most recent one was 1976 when Gerald Ford was battling Ronald Reagan. There were not a majority of delegates going in who were bound. The Mississippi delegation was unbound. There were brokers in those days. And the Mississippi delegation was persuaded of Gerald Ford's credentials and the fact he should continue to be president or have the chance to be president. And so the Mississippi delegation threw its weight for President Ford.
You say persuaded. How are they persuaded?
Well, I think that breaks down to the individual delegates. I believe that there were rides provided on Air Force One.
That's legal?
It's legal. I believe that some wavering delegates were invited to state dinners. That's
wow.
Legal. I believe that there were conversations between Ford aides and delegates about the virtues of Gerald Ford and how he'd be a better candidate for the Republican Party, and that's certainly legal.
So should we expect to see the same kind of stuff from Cruz, Trump, and Kasich? Are they already doing things like that? How are they preparing for this possible open, multi-ballot contested convention?
Just to throw all of them in.
Yeah, just to throw them all in. So I think state dinners are kind of off the table for the Republican candidates this time, which is too bad. But travel to
Mar-a-Lago
Would not be improper, I think, under any existing rules.
What's the Mar-a-Lago?
That would be Donald Trump's luxurious resort and home down in Florida.
Wow.
I think that things like travel and meals and subsistence expenses are all perfectly legal.
Is money?
Oh.
Can you give a delegate just cold, hard cash?
My legal advice would be that might smell like a bribe to somebody, and so probably not a good idea. And I don't think anyone would contemplate the actual payment of dollars.
Not even contemplate.
Well, I believe I believe reporters are contemplating it far more than. Okay.
But a candidate could pay the travel expenses of all these delegates to come to the convention. They could, you know, they can all of the
they would
costs
have to
around
use, they would have to
who can
use
pay for
legally
it,
permissible dollars.
So can the campaign pay for it? Can a super PAC pay for it?
I would say that a super PAC probably cannot pay for
it. But the campaign can.
Yeah. And remember, all of this is uncharted territory. There's not been a contested convention during the same time as these federal election laws were in place. There is a statute that prohibits the offer of a federal job to somebody in return for something. So offering federal jobs is off. But telling somebody that, gee, you look like a really accomplished individual and we want you to be a part of what we get going forward once we're elected is certainly permissible as a thing to talk about.
That's now, politics, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, both Trump and Cruz have staffed up kind of to spearhead this delegate wrangling.
Kasich.
And Kasich, too.
Yeah.
Who has the best delegate wrangling game from what you can see so far?
Well, I think it's still early. I think that the Cruz campaign has spent more time on it early. I think the Trump campaign and the Kasich campaign have hired seasoned professionals to help them deal with all the state conventions and executive committees still to come in April and May and early June.
So if we go through, we're at the convention, we do a first ballot, nobody gets it. What happens? I mean, does it adjourn? You go, you know, we know you have to go to a second ballot, but like, if you, to the best you can, like, take us in that room and what happens if a candidate doesn't get it the first time around?
Mirth and mayhem will prevail. So what will happen at the end of the first ballot is that there will be sort of a pause. I would imagine convention officials will huddle. The rules call for at least an hour before ballots because that's the time to get nominated.
So there'll be an hour in between first and second
ballot.
There'll
be at least an hour in between, I believe, and maybe more. As a parliamentary rule, you want to give everyone a chance to talk and discuss and make deals and try and persuade.
And who is that parliamentary, the sort of umpire on the field, who makes sure that that process is following rules?
That will be set by the convention as one of its first acts of business. So
who is it usually?
Usually it is the ranking Republican in the House of Representatives.
So Paul Ryan. Who has been mentioned as a possible dark horse candidate.
Well, he has, but that's conspiratorial, so.
Okay. We'll come back to that.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. But, okay. So Paul Ryan is kind of in charge?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, what happens is the convention will choose who its permanent chairman is. They'll also choose who the parliamentarian is. That's usually the ranking Republican on the House Rules Committee. Because our convention sessions, by previous rule, are done under the rules of the House of Representatives. That's also a rule that can be amended by the Rules Committee, by the way.
Okay.
The first rule of the Rules Committee is there are no rules until the Rules Committee sets the rules.
For the rules for the procedure of the convention, yes.
Okay. RNC Fight Club.
Also, this might be a dumb question, but like who exactly is on the floor? Like who are all of the groups of people that are on the convention floor? I know that the delegates are there, but there are also reps from the campaign that are on the floor.
Yeah,
can you run me through the list real quick?
There are a number of passes that are given to other groups. There will be representatives of the campaigns who will each be permitted some number of people to be whips. You'll be able to identify them by the colorful and somewhat garishly colorful hats that they wear.
What's a whip?
A whip is somebody who is responsible for a certain number of delegates in a certain number of states to be able to get the campaign's message to them on particular votes.
Like a vote
what's
counter.
Happening. Yeah.
So them and then who
vote
else?
Vote motivator as much as a counter.
And so who else is out there?
There'll be lots of officials from the convention. There will probably be a few passes even to the media. I suspect they'll be somewhat sought after. and that's really, you need to limit access to the convention floor. Otherwise, it does become a little bit unruly.
Are the candidates on the floor?
Generally not. By tradition, candidates don't come on to the convention and certainly don't appear before the convention. To every once in a while on the night before their nomination speech to greet the vice president. But the candidates are not historically on the floor. But to be honest, for this session, if it's really contested, that president could go out the window.
You could see like a Trump or a Cruz or Kasich coming out to try to like wheel and deal?
Yeah, yes, you could see them coming out to wheel and deal. More likely, they'll be in a back room somewhere off the convention floor, perhaps at a hotel nearby.
So we're after the first ballot. No one's got the nomination. All these people are on the floor. We're adjourned. You know, what happens if we call it back to order for a second ballot?
So you will be called back to order. One of the intriguing questions will be what the Rules Committee decides to do about nominations. Can other candidates be nominated at that point? The answer is maybe. As of right now, as of the rules as they were in place in 2012, you probably would be able to put in nomination petitions if you could find a majority of delegates in eight states or whatever number this convention decides. If you're a bound delegate, you can't sign somebody else's petition, but about 73% of the delegates will become unbound after
the
first ballot, so they could sign nomination petitions for somebody else.
So that hour between first and second ballot, or hour or more, right? What are the kinds of deals that might be made? Well, the last time this happened, what were the kinds of deals that were made?
Oh, I don't really know what the specific kinds of deals are. I think, although there's a great desire to think that there are deals, there's more persuasion.
Okay.
And it's more, this candidate will be the best nominee for the Republican Party. That's why you should vote for him. Or this will matter to your state. I promise to come in and campaign in your state is one of the things that people often ask for. So I think it will be more persuasion of the merits of the candidates than what you would perceive as a deal.
But these delegates are party diehards who have been involved in this election for months. If they haven't they already made up their mind? Like, what is the likelihood of them really, like, how much are people up to be persuaded at that point in the game?
See, I don't think you know who the delegates are yet to know that the party diehards are really going to be elected as the delegates.
Okay.
So I think that the mindset of a convention is usually unique to that convention. And I think what people are thinking after a first ballot that doesn't work, if it goes multiple ballots, then that sort of collective mindset of a convention can be very, very different over time.
Well, I know you say that you can't offer a federal job, okay? But there's one big federal job that could be offered, right? Vice president. I mean, you think about John Kasich and Marco Rubio coming in. You know, Rubio's got 170-plus delegates. Kasich has 140-plus, maybe some more, depending on how he does in some of these upcoming states. Could we see, is that a reason why some of these guys hold on to those delegates?
I don't think it's so much to be vice president, but the tactics of the candidates is pretty interesting. Do you name who you're going to run with in advance, what Ronald Reagan did with Richard Schweiker in 1976, to try and bring more delegates to a ticket, or do you wait till you're at the convention to see what the state of the convention is and then offer somebody a vice presidency?
What do you think is the smarter play?
I will tell you that on June 8th. Well, that's when you have a pretty good idea what the first ballot will be, and who's voted how and who the delegates are.
And then so when we go back to the second ballot, the vast majority of the delegates then become unbound, which means they can vote for whoever they want, right?
Correct.
And then that just keeps round-robbing around and around until you get to the magic number?
Yes, at least in theory. I mean, again, nobody's gone through that.
Yeah.
So do convention officials and the candidates kind of agree it's better to roll a number of votes on the first day of the convention? Do they decide that a little time would actually heal a lot of wounds and let's, like, pick up the next day in the morning? I mean, I think that there are lots of sort of decisions that will have to be made on the ground as the convention progresses if it goes to more than one ballot.
And they've kept, the RNC has kept sort of a pocket day, right? You know, they could stay an extra day in Cleveland if they need to, if the process stays long.
Well, I believe that they are dealing with all contingencies. There's something of a question in the mindset of delegates about paying for extra hotel rooms.
Oh, yeah.
What about the flight fees? God, you hate extra flight fees and baggage fees.
Now, what's
about my kid has a Little League game on Saturday morning. I need to get home.
Well, can we go back to what we did talk about a little bit? But let's go back to the dark horse thing, the question of the dark horse candidate. So it sounds like there is an actual process by which it is feasible.
There is a way that it's feasible, sure.
Walk us through that way.
Well, this is like the eight-sided bank shot in a pool game on the likelihood of it. But the way that it would work is that I think after multiple ballots, if a convention could not agree on a majority nominee, that in fact the pressure on the delegates to conduct their business, pick a nominee, would get so intense that other names could be put into nomination. So there are a number of ways to get to that point. Maybe that the original rule would allow for a majority of unbound delegates to sign the petitions. It might be that the standard of if it starts at 8 states gets reduced down after multiple ballots. But it would involve in each instance some number of delegates signing a petition for somebody who was not one of the three original.
So does that mean, though, that Rule 40B, even if they vote for to keep it right beforehand, if it gets so many ballots that they could change that?
There is a way for the Convention Rules Committee to go back into session to change the rules. You might write that into the original rule. There's something in the rules that talks about motions to suspend the rules. That could be used to go back and rewrite the nominating rules.
Now, we have to say, you obviously worked for Mitt Romney both in 2008 and 2012. His running mate in 2012 was Paul Ryan. And we hear both of those names thrown around as people that could be potential dark horse candidates. As someone who has worked for both of those men, do you think that this is an absolutely ludicrous idea?
Well, I think, as I said, that the mindset of a convention changes over time. So the idea of a white knight candidate who's not currently part of the process is theoretically possible. But again, it's the eight-sided bank shot that it would actually get to that point.
Do you prefer white knight or dark horse?
I prefer white knight.
Okay.
White knight on a dark horse.
Yeah. White knight on a dark horse. There
so,
you go.
Okay.
Riding into the queue.
We have talked through all of the things that could possibly happen based on your knowledge of
so much.
We haven't
even scratched
it. I know, right?
But, 101 yeah, of what yeah. could
this
possibly
is,
happen.
This is as much as my brain can handle. What are, like, if you had to say three possible likely scenarios for the convention, can you name the three most likely and which is the most likely of those three?
Like sure. If the dark horse is the eight-sided bank shot,
yeah.
Like
what is
are
the most likely scenario?
What's the one-sided bank shot?
Yeah.
So there are three. I'll give you three different possible
That's
scenarios.
That's what I want, yeah.
One is the clear winner. I would put more money on that than anything else. We are Republicans. We like things neat and tidy. There, by history, you would think that somebody does get to the magic 1237 number. In which case you have a clear winner and a peaceful convention.
That's scenario one.
Scenario one.
Peace.
So there is clear winner. Scenario number two, let's call the clear cluster.
Cluster's unclear.
That's the situation where no candidate is within proximity to getting the majority. So if it 1237 is the magic number, it's somewhere around 1,100 delegates that someone comes in with. That's a situation where there will be all sorts of disagreements and discussions over the rules so that one candidate or another stands a better chance under the rules. It is difficult in that scenario where the camps get locked in to see somebody actually succeeding in getting to 1237, except after a long period of time. But that's kind of a fair fight.
So multiple ballots, though.
But multiple ballots.
Okay.
So the third scenario is the party buster scenario. If you're going to have a clear cluster, you got to have a party buster too.
Okay.
So the party buster is when a candidate is within close proximity to the majority but doesn't have it. And if that candidate, Donald Trump seems the most likely under the current delegate totals, comes into the convention with 1,200 delegates and needs 1,237, and somehow is denied that 1,200, that's the most contentious scenario that you could have. But it's going to be one of those three just by dint of math.
Of those three, which is, at this point, in your mind, the most likely?
Clear winner, just based on history.
Okay.
The clear winner.
You think Trump, even needing like 60% of the remaining delegates or so, is most likely to get the 1,237 before?
Well, his campaign has said they believe they have a clear path. I think New York coming up on April 19th is extremely important to that. It's his home state. If he sweeps New York, that gives him a leg up, especially going into the other Northeast Mid-Atlantic states on April 26th, in which he seems to be doing quite well in the polls. The month of May is a very light month in the Republican primary. Indiana is on May 3rd. That's probably a pretty tough state for him. Mm-hmm. Nebraska and West Virginia are kind of toss-up states at this point, I think, the next week. And then you have Oregon and then Washington, and they're proportionally divided states. So that's not a particular that will put a lot of pressure on the June 7th states.
California,
172 delegates, only 13 delegates go to the statewide winner. Then. Yeah. Hmm. The rest are delegate are CD by CD.
So you referenced this a little bit earlier, but how do we get a vice president in this process?
So the vice president is nominated under the same rule as the president. So it's a majority of delegates in whatever number this convention decides it's going to be. You need to circulate the petitions for a vice presidential candidate. There is a special rule for vice presidents that say if there's only one candidate whose name is put in nomination, you vote for that candidate by acclamation. There is no roll call. But if two candidates manage to get their names put in, then you do go through a roll call in a potential fight again.
Hmm. So you could have a contested open convention for a vice presidential nominee as well.
You could.
So a lot of what I hear in the chatter about a possible contested open multi-ballot not brokered convention is looking back at the last time these kind of things have happened, you know, 76 or this year or that year. None of those conventions were in the era of social media and the internet and the smartphone. How does that change the equation? Like, does it make it harder for a delegate wrangler to wrangle when every delegate on that floor has access to a smartphone and live tweeting?
Or does it make it easier?
So I don't think you know if it's harder or easier because we've never had to do it before.
Yeah.
But certainly there are more tools at your disposal.
Yes.
To contact people on a regular basis. On the other hand, that also is sort of a fertile breeding ground for phantom deals, for bad rumors, for negatives about one candidate or one idea or another. So I think it's a great question with an unknowable answer that if you go to multi-ballots, does social media help or hurt the process? It certainly changes it dramatically anything we've
had before.
How do
we change it? It's not a game of telephone anymore. It's a game of what?
Game of smartphone.
Yeah,
imagine, just imagine the sort of infrastructure that you've got to build into the arena to be sure nobody's systems crash.
Well, I mean, are they going to have enough Wi-Fi for everybody?
Well, I think that smart campaigns are looking for alternatives to Wi-Fi. Can you figure out another way? Closed systems.
Can I ask you a question? This is more of a personal question. So you have been doing this. You've been an elections lawyer, a campaign finance lawyer. You've been involved in processes across parties and elections. Is this year in this scenario, like, do you feel like this is like your Super Bowl or is this like your worst nightmare?
A little both. I mean, look, we all, the unanticipated events are kind of just a hallmark of politics generally. I thought I'd never be involved in a presidential recount. Yeah. I thought they were absolutely impossible to take place. Well, lo and behold, one happened. And I think that having this much contention in both political parties with sort of the mix of candidate types who you've got involved makes this year, 2016, clearly a different year from any that we've had before. So that's both exhilarating and terribly frightening.
What advice would you give to the teams and the candidates that are getting ready to duke this thing out?
Details really matter a lot. It is a matter of gaming out to the best you can exactly what you're going to need for all the situations that you can find. And that role playing and gaming things out is really an intricate process. We went through weeks and weeks of it in 2012 when there was a clear nominee and we knew what was going to happen. None of the campaigns this time are going to quite have the luxury of that because you know, we had 3.5 months from the time Mitt Romney wrapped up the nomination to when the convention is. At best, there will be 40 days from when the nominee is known to prepare for the convention. So it's a matter of planning out the scenarios and having the people in place to be able to execute on your strategies, and then knowing how to communicate with your team to move the pieces on the chessboard.
Yeah. All right. So, Ben, on the podcast every week, we do this thing called Can't Let It Go. And it's where we all go around the table and share one thing that we just could not stop thinking about that week. Would you happen to have one thing that you can't stop thinking about that you could share with us? And you can pick anything from this
campaign. It doesn't
have
to be this week,
season.
But it could be like this campaign.
What's
is
the one thing that's still stuck
to?
In your craw?
Like, did the RNC rules or anything?
So what sticks in my craw is that we seem to be debating so much bad information about the rules that you can already see something that's going to be in play at the convention, which is the use of information to achieve results that may not be accurate going in.
So what sticks? Why is that something that's sticky for you?
Because there's so much bad information.
Not on this podcast.
There about it. Not on this podcast. But hopefully this podcast will help clear that
that's
up.
That's right.
Do you think the bad information, though, is coming from what? From does the RNC not do a good enough job explaining it? Is it the media? Is it candidates saying the system's rigged?
Misinterpreting.
So look, discussions about rules is similar to what happens when people talk about baseball. Like, everybody can manage a campaign better than the manager, or manage yeah. a baseball team better than the manager can. So there are tons of ideas. It's not dissimilar to reporters when lots of people say, why didn't you ask that question? So I think that's what's really going on. The RNC is trying to explain it.
It's a complicated system.
It's a complicated system.
You know, it's like, because not only do you have like the federal process, but it's like 50 states and the areas all have their own rules.
Yep. Well, it's bad for the public and good for lawyers.
Okay, we made it. Thank you for sticking with that conversation. That's a wrap. Did we cover it all, you guys?
Maybe we can
slow clap.
And then some.
Yeah.
I'll take a slow clap.
Yeah.
This is like.
It was fun.
You know, I enjoyed it.
We got to it all, but those rules are really important. I mean, getting to the details, getting to the granularity, that is the stuff that people are going to need to know on the convention floor, and we can pull out of those things so that we don't feel like we're, you know, in a turnstile, whipping around, not having any idea what's going on.
It is also a little mind-boggling that we really did just scratch the surface of the intricacies of parliamentary process, how rules are written, how they could be amended in real time. I mean, this is just like...
So much drama. Okay.
So much drama.
Yeah. All right, we will see you later in the week with our own Can't Let It Goes. As always, you can write the show, share your feedback, send us questions at nprpolitics@npr.org. And thank you for rating us on iTunes. That helps other people find the show. I'm Sam Sanders, campaign reporter.
I'm Susan Davis. I cover Congress.
And I'm Domenico Montanaro, political editor.
Thank you for listening to the NPR Politics Podcast.